Feminist women.
Mulheres feministas.
زنان فمینیست.
بانیو و چیکونزرو چه وکادی.
نساء.
Mulheres feministas.
Young femini. Fem activist.
Nari Mukti.
Matapan na babae. Kechi mai ka ishk.
Welcome to Women's Magazine. I am your host, Lisa Detmer. Today for Queer Pride, we will devote the entire show to a radical queer's critique of gay marriage, since it is such a prominent issue today, but is rarely given any feminist or radical queer critique. So stay tuned. Recently, I spoke with several radical queers about their perspective on the mainstream gay marriage movement and some problems they saw in the way the movement is formulated. I talked to two recent graduates of UC Berkeley's African American Studies Graduate Department, Matt Richardson and Marlon Bailey, to Lisa Dugan, the author of The Twilight of Equality, Neoliberalism, Cultural Politics, and the Attack of Democracy, and to Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, the editor of That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation. My name is Lisa Detmer, and today we are talking about a radical queer's critique of the gay marriage movement in the U.S., and we are facing a lot of hostility when we say we don't agree with this agenda. In my experience, many queers, whether they're poor, immigrant, wealthy, or good liberals, feel that this movement is only asking for equality and is an important civil rights issue. And even progressive queers have felt that while they do not support marriage as a political agenda, they feel like they have no choice but to support it because of the virulent right-wing attack that threatens real rights such as adoption, immigration rights. Few people have been able to have the distance, nor has the dialogue been allowed to question what is going on here. Hopefully, we can provide some insight today. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Kenyon Farrow has written that the press has portrayed the opponents of gay marriage as black and the proponents of gay marriage as white, and that the white gay movement is as much to blame as the Christian right for the way the campaign has been constructed and their appropriation of black civil rights language. And Matt, I know you look at how gay marriage movement is represented, what is the images and rhetoric it uses and how that is problematic. Can you talk about that and address what maybe Kenyon is talking about here?
Yeah, I think this is Kenyon's article, Is Gay Marriage Anti-Black?
Exactly.
I think that that's the article you're referring to. And I think that Kenyon is right on in his assessment that the white lesbian and gay establishment mainstream is particularly unconscionable in their use of black history and black people's lives and struggles for agendas that do not take into account black people at all and those histories. So, for example, one of the things that is, you know, particularly egregious that is taking place not only now, but, you know, in the early 1990s when people were looking at gays in the military and also questioning issues around gay marriage at that time, was a constant comparison between blacks and gays. It kind of reminds me of early white feminist comparison, women and blacks, right? It's like the move that does so many things at once, particularly erasing black queer people off the map, so that if you have blacks and gays, of course, you know, you can then never the twain shall meet, right? They're considered to be mutually exclusive categories. But what is even more, I think, violent is the appropriation of black civil rights movement struggles, concepts, ideas, constantly referring to black people as having won civil rights, as having won citizenship, as being the model of a struggle that is over. And so what that does, of course, is do violence to the present circumstances and conditions of black people, which are overwhelmingly violent and hostile and continuously living and struggling in anti-black and extremely racist, misogynistic, and homophobic world, such that any kind of even hint that black people have already gained citizenship and have, acquired the legal status or the extra legal condition of citizen is a lie, and like I said, just does violence to black people's current conditions, as well as does violence to the history of black struggle in the United States. And what is it? What does it mean to go through slavery? What does it mean to go through various kinds of movements for basic rights? So I think that is the main thing that is particularly unpalatable for black people to hear, either queer or straight, to have white people compare themselves to black struggles, and with seemingly no sense of history and no sense of why that shouldn't happen, especially because, you have black queer people who are currently living through, homophobia and transphobia and all of it.
And I think you looked at some of the images that are used in the gay marriage movement and how they perpetuate this. Did you want to talk a little about that?
I was particularly looking at recent news footage, right, where it would be a shot at the courthouse in San Francisco with a very white crowd and, white couples, either white or interracial couples, getting married. And it was just overwhelmingly white. And then I looked at some of the anti-gay propaganda from the early 1990s from a film called Gay Rights, Special Rights, which took, again, just took the white gay mainstream images that were already in place and already in force and showed an entirely white crowd, white people standing up and again and again talking about the black civil rights movement and comparing themselves to black people in the ways that are problematic that I just described. And that was from 1994. Those images are particularly detrimental for any kind of movement building that would be useful to black people in any way, shape, or form. And they have been used perpetually for a very long time. Like I said, I was looking at images from the early 1990s.
So, Marlon, you raised the question of whether black people want to share a political agenda that the conservative gays like the Log Cabin Republicans have and state that historically it's been dangerous for black people to uncritically ally themselves with white movements. How do you see a gay marriage movement and perhaps marriage in general as not a benefit to black people? And also, how would you address black queers who support gay marriage?
Well, I'll start by adding to something that Matt has focused on, and that is how these issues are represented as opposed to the reality. And I think one problem is something that Matt already pointed to, but I saw a particular example of that when I went to the Log Cabin Republicans website, and the images that they had on the website were quite disturbing. In the backdrop of an interview that they publicized with Vice President Cheney, the interesting thing about that was in the backdrop of that interview, they had a For Colored Only sign, so it erected this civil rights imagery to demonstrate sort of that marriage is the last bastion of equality. Everything else has, been accomplished. And I think that, as Matt aptly pointed out, is a very disturbing representation.
And as if the Log Cabin Republicans supported civil rights.
Absolutely. And the Log Cabin Republicans, on every position, I actually did a perusal of the positions that they take on politics and social policy, and every position that they take, with the exception of possibly marriage, is totally inconsistent with historical positions that Black people have taken in many ways, particularly when it comes to politics and social policy. And I want to address the latter question that you asked about what happens when Black queer people uncritically subscribe to politics that are purported by the sort of larger gay community, which is predominantly represented as white and upwardly mobile, if not privileged. Another observance that I had was attending a town hall meeting conducted by the Black Justice Coalition.
National Black Justice Coalition.
And it was a town hall meeting in Oakland, and I decided to go to see what transpired. And what I observed was people who are in the clergy and people who are kind of prominent in Black gay communities in the Bay Area, alongside this marriage equality movement, was a discussion of coming out, that trying to encourage everyone to come out, all, you know, saying that, you know, it improves the quality of life when you come out, and so on and so forth. Now, I raised the question of the panel, is like, well, you know, a lot of people can't afford to claim a gay identity, nor do they want to. And are we sure that gay or marriage equality is our issue, or is an issue for us to be focusing on, as opposed to the more larger and broader issues about equitable distribution of resources, mm-hmm. poverty, HIV, AIDS. Mm-hmm. And other people on the panel also said, well, you know, marriage equality can help to prevent HIV AIDS infection.
Oh, no. No, they didn't.
Yes, so it became the proverbial condom. And I think that this is what is disturbing, because there was no problematizing of the institution of marriage at all. And on either debate, either side of these debates, the multiple sides that exist, there is no critical or no subjecting of marriage to any kind of scrutiny in its historical mm-hmm. practices and current practices of exclusion, and as the barometer of citizenship and humanity and sexual regulation and so on and so forth. You were going to say something.
So maybe we could go into more how marriage hasn't benefited Black people and other people. And for instance, some people have talked about how Black kinships were and are deliberately attacked and pathologized in order to make white families stable and legitimized. And
yeah.
This is the same family that progressives are pushing. When progressives pushing family, it isn't immune from this racism. So can we talk a little bit about the relationship between the state's attempt to get, for instance, welfare benefits tied to marriage and its mm-hmm. continuation of more enhanced regulations of Black
right.
women begun in 1960, and how this informs this issue? So looking at marriage and the history of marriage here.
Right. And I would say that, well, let me start by saying that that marriage and what I call the nuclear family ideal is just that. It's an ideal. A little less than 50% of American families are headed by married households, and even less amount of that have children. And it's projected by 2010, only 25% will look like this nuclear family. So it is something that needs to be put up to a certain kind of scrutiny in terms of reality. Marriage is too, that institution is too rigid for most American families. And so it's a troubled institution at best, a failing one at worst. So that's one thing. But then it gets erected to say that, oh, well, speaking of the Moynihan Report, well, because certain cultures, quote unquote, do not subscribe to these rigid characteristics of family or so on and so forth, that they are backward. And I think that what has happened mm-hmm. is that Black people have constantly felt sort of amputated, in a sense that our kinship structures have been very important to us, but they have not reflected this nuclear familial idea, nor has nor has the national citizenry, particularly in the last 50 years. And so, but what happens is that Black people get put in this situation where we feel that we have to sort of overcompensate. So the virulent defense of marriage that we see in sort of the aligning of Black conservatives and religious and clergy, members of the clergy, and right-wing white, a largely white aspect of that movement in opposition, is Black people being co-opted and using, capitalizing on our feelings of inferiority because our familial makeup has not represented this ideal. On the other end, those like the National Black Justice Coalition, they then move to a sort of civil rights logic to be included in this institution to overcompensate for their feelings of dysfunction in terms of not subscribing to heteronormative notions of family. And so what they're saying is, oh yeah, we can be gay, but we can be married, and so therefore our sexuality can become normalized. And I think that what the problem is that Black people's sexuality is already deemed as dysfunctional for a variety of reasons that are about the white supremacy that exists in this country and the convergence of gender and sexuality oppression. To then capitulate to these notions that to become normal and normative means that you have to adhere to this ideal, it then becomes a real problem because it doesn't address the larger issues that affect all of Black people. Not only all of Black people, it affects the majority of the citizenry. And that is the inequitable distribution of resources and the erosion of social welfare and social programs that protect the citizenry that all of the citizens should have the right to.
Right, and that history of the welfare benefits and the attack on the regulation of Black people, I think that's really important. Matt, did you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, I actually did, because I think that a part of this fantasy, right, this fable that Black people have already achieved citizenship, a part of what that does is, say that, look, these people have gotten their citizenship. They have the 1964 Civil Rights Act, so that it sets up the story such that everything else that Black people talk about in the current moment, it must be just kind of our own making. Black people have already gotten the citizenship that they so desperately wanted. So what is it that they seem to need now? And it sets up, right, this white gay citizen and this potential nuclear family as the nuclear family that Black people could never be. I think that it absolutely one that says, look, Moynihan was right. What you really need is this two-parent household. So what if it's two men or two women? Clearly, these Black people could never do it right. We can do it. We white lesbians and gay men, we can do it right. And we can have the nuclear family. This is a model that everyone should have, and we can do it. And so I really think that it absolutely goes right back to that Moynihan model of the tangle of pathology in reference to Black people.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that? Because most people have no idea about the Moynihan.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan put out this report in 1965 that had tremendous impact. And what it said was that it was looking at Black people in particular. And it singled out Black people because it was just about, like, what is the problem with Black people, right? At the time, it was the language of the Negro problem. And so this is at the height of civil rights movement, right? It's at the cusp and the dawning of a Black power movement. And it says that all of these, it basically kind of puts all of the fights for equality, for justice, for people to understand that there's anti-Black violence happening all over the country. It puts all of that aside and says, no, what's really the matter with these Black people is that they don't have the right family structure. Their men aren't the heads of the households. The women are the heads of households. And that makes for what Moynihan called a tangle of pathology. And he also said that, Black people were out of step with the rest of American society because of this twisted family structure in his mind. Now, that particular call for, a patriarchal nuclear family in Black households has been specifically and particularly effective on the and every level, on the level of, you know, all levels of policy, right? All levels of even, you know, black people will even call for the strengthening of the family. This, you know, this it was a very insidious idea, and it came about at the precise moment that it needed to in order to, like, really shift the focus from people talking about anti-black violence, things are happening to black people, and shift the focus directly to, like, what was going on within black families. And I think that that's gotten absorbed in a variety of different ways.
Can you talk about that, like, how the welfare benefits being tied to marriage that Clinton initiated, how that informs the gay marriage issue?
Clinton's Defense of Marriage Act, but then also the encouragement to marriage, right? That was put in place for a long time. They have been regulating, but well before Clinton, right? They've been regulating black women who've gotten aid to family and dependent children, AFDC, otherwise known as welfare, for a long time. You go to black women's houses, and there would be, like, you know, a single worker that would go from house to house, and they still do, right? And make sure that there was no male contributing to the house that was not married to the woman. And it was all about absolutely controlling and regulating black women's sexuality and sexual reproduction. I mean, I think that this goes hand in hand with, you know, sterilization, for example, Norplant, that was very popular in the 1990s and I guess still continues to be a popular form of regulation of black reproduction. And so, you know, I think that part of what this link is that it sheds light on the fact that black people have a different relationship to the state. The government is absolutely directly involved in black people's homes and is particularly interested in when and how black women reproduce and when and how black women are connected to a male partner. So this, like, regulation of black women's heterosexuality and enforcement of heterosexuality, as well as an enforcement of limited reproduction and rebirth, is infused in how the government functions and that relationship to black people. Also, a part of that is the Child Protective Service system, which is much more involved in black families' homes. All kinds of social welfare systems, right, are absolutely plugged into poor black people's homes and environments, such that, you know, black people's children are always much more at risk of being taken away by the state. Mm-hmm. Black people, you know, of course, are always more at risk of being incarcerated by the state, right? And so much about black people's sexuality and lives are already under state surveillance that it doesn't make any sense, I don't think, for black people to embrace gay marriage as yet another way that the state can can intervene into our lives, but also because our families are so vulnerable in all these other ways, marriage isn't necessarily going to protect them in the ways that people think they are. I mean, the National Black Justice Coalition and other places talk about the many different rights and protections of marriage. Black people don't have that kind of relationship to government functioning such that it's about protection.
So, Lisa, in your book, The Twilight of Equality, Neoliberalism, Cultural Politics, and the Attack on Democracy, you talk about how the gay movement has moved to the right in general.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that and how that has helped lead to a narrow conservative gay marriage movement?
Well, the problem with the, the gay movement establishment has moved to the right over the past 20 years as it has become increasingly a set of lobbying and litigation organizations. They base their decision making on the wishes primarily of their funders. They don't really have constituencies anymore. So most of the national lesbian and gay rights organizations are, you know, focused on electing people in congressional and state and citywide races, or else they're dedicated to influencing court decisions, but their priorities are set by a small number of individual and foundation donors. And of course, that automatically limits it to the most elite a tiny elite segment of the lesbian and gay population. And those are the people who are setting the priorities for lesbian and gay politics for the most part. There are a lot of LGBT and queer organizations locally that have far more progressive agendas. Like here in New York, we have the Audre Lorde's Project, we have Queers for Economic Justice, organizations that have much broader agendas and who are very critical of the marriage-only agenda of the national organizations. But the grassroots organizations who have real constituencies are not really being heard in the, you know, the sort of media landscape that is dominated by the national organizations. So, you know, the way that they think about marriage and access to marriage is very much about getting access to the ways in which property ownership and inheritance are organized through marriage. And it's such a narrow framing of what marriage is and what marriage does for a small number of people. They're not actually thinking about marriage and marriage politics, broadly speaking. And framing it as an equality issue is actually completely to misrepresent same-sex marriage a movement is actually trying to accomplish. If you look at marriage politics in the broad sweep, and here several other panelists have been speaking about this, to add to that, marriage is, in the current political moment, a kind of privatization scheme. And what I mean by that is, over the past 30 years, there's been a political effort on the right by neoliberals and by conservatives to downsize the already very limited and biased and welfare state in the United States, to downscale it, to eliminate the few programs that the United States has that have been redistributive of resources, to get rid of welfare, to privatize Social Security, to take government services like garbage collection and turn them over to private corporations. So privatization is a strategy by which services and redistribution are taken out of democratically accessible hands, transferred to private and corporate hands, and turned into money-making corporate enterprises that put money into profits and takes money out of services. So over 30 years, this effort has gained steam. So marriage becomes kind of a privatization scheme. And what I mean by that is it's through emphasis on the sanctity, the importance, the centrality of marriage that conservatives, both moral and fiscal conservatives, argue that it's private households headed by married couples that should perform the social services rather than the state. So we don't need to spend money on preschools when children should be taken care of at home. We shouldn't spend money on health care and taking care of dependents because all of those things should be done in private households where women's unpaid labor primarily, or in the case of wealthy women, poor and women of color are paid to do these services privately under conditions where they have, you know, very low wages and no benefits. There's a shift of services from collective, democratically run programs into private households. And the idealization of marriage is one of the rhetorical strategies through which this is accomplished. In the case of welfare, which a couple of the panelists have already talked about, it's really very explicit. The 1996 welfare reform bill under the Clinton administration called for the promotion of marriage as a way to get poor women off of welfare and to shift that cost onto private households. Then later, under the Bush administration, during the period of reauthorization of that welfare bill, Bush put $1.5 billion into welfare reauthorization for the purpose of marriage promotion. That's taking money out of direct services and putting it into teaching poor women why they should be married and why they should be dependent on husbands rather than collecting any kind of help from the mass of people through redistribution by the state. So the promotion of marriage and the language that promotes marriage, you know, the personal responsibility is in the title of the welfare bill. It's a set of terms that are used to co-well marriage and going to work. Those are matters of personal responsibility, and everything else, you know, using any kind of mechanism to collectively redistribute resources and care for dependents, you know, that is lazy, irresponsible, and needs to be corrected. So that marriage is put in place then as the thing that responsible people do and that the state should encourage them to do. So the lesbian and gay rights movement has actually been using some of the same language to talk about marriage as a matter of responsibility, and to show that lesbian and gay people are worthy citizens because they can show the responsibility to get married, and echoing then a set of rhetorics that are being used to, you know, to shift responsibility onto private households, primarily onto the shoulders of women and poor women and women of color. In some cases, this is explicit. You know, some lesbian and gay marriage promoters know very well that marriage has this function of privatizing social welfare, and it's in their language. They say explicitly that marriage is also good because it gets poor women off the state dole and into these private households, and that's what we all want. Some lesbian and gay marriage promotion people say the same kind of thing. Others use the language and don't necessarily make the connection to the set of economic policies that are contained in marriage promotion right now, over the past 10 years or so, especially the use of marriage to privatize a downsizing of the welfare state. You know, there's an unself-consciousness on the part of some folks about using that language, and others are very self-conscious about it. And what the lesbian and gay rights establishment does not do is look at, and broadly speaking, what marriage politics are doing today, and also look at the fact that, you know, most of us, gay, straight, queer, transgender, most of us actually don't live in households that are well served by this one-size-fits-all kind of recognition anyway, and that what we need is to diversify and democratize the forms of recognition for various households, to decenter marriage, if not, you know, calling to abolish marriage never goes over very well, but calling to decenter marriage and to diversify and democratize forms of household recognition to make it possible for people in non-conjugal relationships, in multiple conjugal relationships, in, you know, several generation households, to get various kinds of recognitions and benefits that they need without having to conform to the model of marriage. That's what all of us would truly benefit from, that and having benefits be universalized rather than made accessible to us through marriage. One of the panelists said, you know, the government accounting office says there's 1,048, I think it is, benefits and responsibilities that come with marriage. You know, those benefits that come through marriage, like Social Security or health care, they should be available to all of us, whether we're, you know, married, unmarried, whether we're citizens or not citizens, whether we're, you know, that it should be available. Those benefits should be universalized. Calling to make them available through marriage is actually a relatively conservative kind of claim that the lesbian and gay rights establishment is presenting as progressive.
In your article on gay marriage, you discuss how the attack on gay marriage isn't necessarily successful because of homophobia, but because of the household insecurity that you were talking about.
Yes.
And that this can be the key to a broader vision of a gay movement. Can you explain both of those points?
You know, the last election got reported as being about how values voters elected Republicans, and the argument was that the support for the anti-gay marriage amendments was crucial in organizing this kind of values voter Republican triumph. In the article I wrote with Richard Kim, what we were arguing was that actually, you know, most of the campaigns for those bans on same-sex marriage were not framed in explicitly homophobic terms. The reason that they weren't is because organizations ran focus groups and found that actually they ran into a lot of opposition when they did it that way. So they ran the campaigns as save traditional marriage, save marriage, preserve marriage, and that was the primary language for most of them. So that what they were tapping into, Richard and I believe, is a kind of panic on the part of many people that in the face of cutbacks on all kinds of services, and the loss of health care benefits in a lot of jobs, the loss of pension benefits now in a lot of corporations have been cutting their pension benefits, the threat to Social Security, that all of these are creating a kind of economic insecurity almost to the point of panic. And marriage is the symbolic linchpin for the private household, which is the last bastion of a certain kind of security. Like, what's going to happen to you if you're sick and can't take care of yourself and you don't have health insurance? You turn to the private household or to some version of a kin network. So a lot of people panicking about service cutback and loss of resources see anything insecure about the private household or about what marriage means to them in a symbolic sense. They can come out in support of marriage out of that kind of economic insecurity, and not explicitly out of homophobia. Not that homophobia doesn't play a role, right? It does. But that the Republican Party has become extremely good at manipulating economic insecurity and framing issues in a way that bring out a certain kind of fear, and that it's perfectly possible that people voting to save marriage, preserve marriage by supporting these anti-same-sex marriage amendments are actually thinking primarily about their economic insecurity, and they're being, in some sense, manipulated by the language of the and the rhetoric of the campaigns for the amendments. And the problem for all of us is that the Democratic Party is certainly not providing an alternative way of understanding what's happening. What we need is an organized political voice that LGBTQ people should be contributing to talk about the way in which cutbacks and privatization and the reduction of services and benefits, that these are deliberate policies, that these are policies that are being carried out with a specific agenda to create a more passive, compliant, underserved workforce while profits go in greater and greater amounts and percentages into the hands of the very wealthy, which is what has been happening over the past 10 to 20 years. Helping people understand why they're losing their pension, why their services are being cut, and what is causing this economic insecurity will then allow the anger and anxiety to be directed at the right targets, and to understand actually that voting to preserve marriage is not going to help, is not going to in any way make for more benefits and services and redistribution of resources that we all need. It's not going to create that. So we need a political voice more than we need a same-sex marriage campaign, which actually offers no critique whatsoever. We need LGBTQ participation in a broad social critique that says, look what's going on here. Resources are being redistributed upward. That's what's been happening since the 1970s. And this is how this is happening. These are the mechanisms that it's happening through. Somebody needs to be organized to make these arguments. And it's in our interest as LGBTQ people to be a part of that rather than to organize into these single standalone issue campaigns, which ignore the larger context and make really sort of obfuscating and ultimately conservative arguments about single issues.
Okay, so maybe we can get into talking a little bit about what this new strategic vision would be like, what a radical liberatory queer agenda would look like. Because, I mean, for instance, groups like NCLR argue that the fight for gay marriage doesn't mean that they can't also recognize the need to fight for poverty and for larger solutions.
Right.
So I guess we need to really talk about what is that radical agenda going to look like. Matilda, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Would you like to talk a little bit about what your perspective on that is?
Sure. I wanted to sort of add to what Lisa was saying, you know, about the Christian right and the ways in which they cynically manipulate, you know, straight fears of gay marriage. And I want to say that also, you know, I think that the gay marriage movement is complicit with that agenda. And so every time, you know, we see, you know, some sort of debate where on one side you have these, you know, Christian right homophobes saying that gay marriage is the end of Western civilization, and on the other side you have, you know, these gay assimilationists that are saying, you know, gay marriage, you know, it's the best thing since Will and Grace. And I think that that agenda, you know, the two of them are really complicit in silencing any opinions, you know, challenging marriage or arguing for, you know, broader social justice issues like universal access to health care and housing and the benefits of citizenship. You know, I mean, I think those two movements, they fund each other. You know, the gay marriage movement is funded by fears of the Christian right, and the Christian right are funded by fears, you know, of gay people. And I think, unfortunately, you know, these, you know, gay marriage proponents are really misguided in their complicity with the Christian right in silencing, you know, anti-marriage queers. They think, oh, you know, we're the good gay people. You know, we just want to get married. You know, we don't want something like, you know, polyamory or, you know, dangerous things like leather sex or public sex or, you know, multiple partners on any form, in, you know, at any point in our lives. We just want what you have. And, you know, it's almost as if they're arguing for who can silence queers, you know, the quickest. And I also wanted to go back to something that Marlon said. You know, Marlon brought up that, you know, that horrifying concept that gay marriage or marriage equality, you know, prevent HIV. And to build on what a lot of people have been saying about redistribution of resources, money that's going into this fight for marriage, you know, so-called marriage equality, is literally directly being taken away from HIV services, from drug treatment, from housing, absolutely, from domestic violence prevention, and moving, you know, it's redistribution, you know, not only of resources in general, but specifically of resources for so-called activist struggles. Like, that money is all moved over to these pro-marriage proponents. And I think, you know, Marlon sort of touched on this idea that these conservative gay mainstream people, you know, have about this notion that, you know, coming out is, you know, that's the end. You know what I mean? Like, gay identity ends there. And I think it's that sort of notion that has allowed for, you know, all of the markers of straight conformity to be reimagined as the goals, you know, the ultimate goals of gay success. You know, so we have things, not just marriage, but military service and adoption and ordination to the priesthood. You know, all of a sudden, these are the only queer issues on the table. And those aren't queer issues at all. And, you know, things like housing and health care and police brutality and food, that's all, like, thrown in the garbage. And, you know, I think also, you know, building on what Matt was saying, and this is actually coming directly from Matt's work, it's no accident that marriage has been chosen as this goal, you know, marriage as the central institution through which property has been transferred between wealthy white families. And, you know, we can see further, you know, in sort of this, whenever you see a gay marriage protest, you know, what is the dominant symbol of that protest? Is it two loving couples embrace? No, it's the U.S. flag. So it's the stars and stripes. So you have these gay marriage proponents rallying behind the stars and stripes at the same time that the U.S. occupies Iraq, you know, overthrows the only democratically elected government in Haiti, you know, back at the same time as all these marriages were going on in San Francisco, that was going on, or, you know, funds the Israeli war on the Palestinians, and, you know, makes the whole world safe from multinational corporations to plunder indigenous resources. And I think this is the same agenda. This is the same agenda that these mainstream, you know, assimilationist gay people have in rallying behind the flag. It's, you know, erase everything else. And just as long as we, you know, in quotation marks, you know, these gay marriage proponents, as long as we can get the benefits of full citizenship, then just throw everyone else behind that screen and, you know, and get rid of them.
So I wanted to play the devil's advocate, and because there are a lot of people who are immigrants who feel like this is important, people who are not wealthy who feel like this is important, how are we going to explain to them that we are not demonizing them and that we are recognizing that their needs are real? Lisa, did you want to talk about that?
I did, you know, because, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are not wealthy, privileged white people who are in favor of marriage because they see it in the immediate sense as a route to getting a whole set of specific benefits and maybe even to force their families to recognize their relationship. Or there are lots of reasons that people have for wanting marriage, and they're, you know, and that includes lots of folks who are not part of the elite gay rights establishment that we were talking about before. I've talked about this a lot in, like, lesbian and gay community centers as well as other places around the country. And I find that actually people change their minds very quickly from the marriage-only agenda to thinking instead about having a broader array of household and partnership recognitions and calling for universalization of benefits as an alternative to marriage-only. Because though marriage-only looks like it's going to solve some specific problems, it only does that because right now marriage is the only way, very restrictive way, to get access to certain kinds of benefits and privileges. But instead of saying, well, we want some more of us to have access to this restricted way, instead what we want to do is create a broadly democratic means for distributing these benefits. And that isn't hard to understand. The thing that's really surprising is that no one, you know, in the mainstream organizations is saying it, because actually the marriage-only campaign has caused us to lose some alternative statuses that not only LGBT but straight people make wide use of, like domestic partnership and reciprocal beneficiary. Domestic partnership is used by large numbers of people who don't want to get married, and in many cases, marriage only, like in Massachusetts, when gay marriage was won in Massachusetts, a lot of state institutions and corporations there then wanted to do away with domestic partnership. But a lot of straight people who wanted domestic partnership as well as LGBT, because they didn't want the whole architecture of marriage, they wanted something different. Reciprocal beneficiary is much more progressive, even, because it doesn't require a conjugal relationship. You know, so it could be you and your aunt, or, you know, you and your best friend, and you can access certain kinds of medical decision-making rights and tax and advantages and so forth without having to say you have sex. So it takes the state out of the business of sexual regulation when you have something like reciprocal beneficiary. And if we could start with those and expand them to include the kinds of recognitions and benefits people need and have them match a wide array of different kinds of households, rather than only allocate them to this conjugal couple, you know, that would actually be of benefit to many more people. And that's so easy to understand. But the marriage-only campaign is sacrificing domestic partnership and reciprocal beneficiary in order to achieve marriage. So even when marriage is won or in the places where it's lost, the new DOMAs, the backlash DOMAs, often eliminate the possibility of domestic partnership and reciprocal beneficiary too. So we're actually losing the small little window of diversity that we have in forms of recognition as a result of the marriage-only campaign. Marriage actually should be a private religious institution and not a state institution. There's certain things like who makes decisions for you when you're unconscious, or, you know, when you get to have bereavement benefit. I mean, there's certain things that are attached to relationships and relationship recognitions that should just be allocated very broadly and by a choice, rather than tied to something as narrow as marriage. The way that the same-sex marriage campaign is framing it is marriage is the most important and only status that we should be aiming for. Marriage is equality. Marriage is respect. Marriage is legitimation. Marriage is all of these things. And so they are actually endorsing the ideological baggage and the economic role that marriage plays, rather than critiquing it. Instead, if we decenter marriage and have a whole menu of forms of recognition for different kinds of households, some people might still choose marriage, which they could have in their commune or their church or their whatever private ceremony that they would like, but the menu of benefits and recognitions would be multiple and not singular.
Okay, does anybody else want to add to this?
I do want to say something about transgender people in relationship to all of this, because what we haven't been discussing is the fact that they're all whole groups of people who have genders that the state doesn't recognize, right? So this whole rhetoric of same-sex marriage really depends upon there being these recognized and stable positions of man and woman, and actually reifies and reinscribes this idea that there are really only two genders and two sexes, and that have clear boundaries, and that they are absolute
in every way. And I think that, you know, a lot of people who are proposing gay marriage keep reiterating this idea that this is about a woman and a woman and a man, as if these are categories that are not complicated and contested. The agenda towards gay marriage really leaves out a lot about what it means to be queer, right? I think that, you know, we've been talking about like a lesbian and gay agenda rather than a queer one that opens up the varieties of ways of being and embodiment and what kinds of genders that people have and the complicated issues that surround them. That's a part of this discussion that proponents of gay marriage really need to be pushed on, because it leaves out so much about being queer. And people have been talking about this in terms of polyamory, queer lives, and queer culture, the various ways that we have relationships and we have families, and that we, you know, kind of make child care arrangements, also really speak to all of these, the various ways that people are gendered and how richly queer people are gendered, that just gets completely lost and buried, I think, in this debate.
Okay, does anybody else have anything else they want to add before we wrap up?
I just want to say one thing about the forum in general. Like, okay. I think it's great that, you know, here is a forum between people talking about queer issues that actually matter in people's lives instead of that same sort of reactionary Christian right homophobe versus, you know, the wonderful gay mainstream, you know, spokes model. And I think, you know, the straight left is complicit, you know, in that silencing every time. You know, you can hear on Pacifica programs, for example, they talk about gay marriage and they quote the Human Rights Campaign, you know, and the Human Rights Campaign, you know, is an organization that has more in common with the Log Cabin Republicans, you know, or with the National Rifle Association than any sort of left agenda, you know, queer or otherwise. And I think it's important that, you know, we need to complicate these issues and talk also about the complicity of the left in sort of abandoning, you know, any sort of discourse, you know, about queer lives in any way that is complicated at all.
Just begun to get our share of this world's delight. High hopes we have for the future and our goals in sight. No, we don't get depressed. Here's what we call our golden rule. Have faith in you and the things you do. You won't go wrong.
You've been listening to an interview with two recent graduates of UC Berkeley's African American Studies Graduate Department, Matt Richardson and Marlon Bailey, and to Lisa Dugan, the author of The Twilight of Equality, Neoliberalism, Cultural Politics, and the Attack on Democracy, and Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, the editor of That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation. Next up is the Women's Calendar.
This is a listing of upcoming events for or by women in the Bay Area for the week of June 19th through July 3rd. Please listen closely for contact numbers.
Join an honoring of Indigenous women activists Carrie Dan of the Western Shoshone, Louise Benali of the Diné Big Mountain, and Rosalie Little Thunder of the Sikangu Lakota as they speak about human rights, environmental justice, and multinational accountability. Tuesday, June 20th at 7 p.m. at New College Theater, 777 Valencia at 19th Street in San Francisco, $5 to $20 sliding scale. For information, call 415-641-4482 or go to www.newcollege.edu, wheelchair accessible.
The San Francisco chapter of the National Organization for Women is celebrating the summer solstice and the feminist community. There will be presentations, dancers, a silent auction, and live jazz. Wednesday, June 21st at 6 p.m. at La Colonial, 20 Cosmo Place near Union Square in San Francisco. For information, call 415-404-6365 or visit www.sfnow.org. Wheelchair accessible.
A revolutionary theater piece, Oh My Goddess, written and performed by Sherry Glasser, that is both hilariously funny and deeply moving, is showing Thursday, June 22nd, through Saturday, July 15th at 8 p.m. at The Marsh, 1062 Valencia and 22nd Street in San Francisco. $15 to $22 sliding scale. For info, call 415-641-0235 or visit www.themarsh.org. Wheelchair accessible.
Celebrate the solstice with storytellers and poets Louisa Tesh and multi-percussionist Avacha on Friday, June 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at Love in Motion, 1137 34th Street and Adeline in Oakland. $10 to $15 sliding scale. For information, call 510-655-1894 or visit www.avotcja.com. Wheelchair accessible.
A silent auction and cocktail party benefit will be held to support the completion of the film Soledad Is Gone Forever, about one woman's journey back to her childhood during the Pinochet era in Chile. Friday, June 23rd at 6 p.m. at New College Cultural Center, 766 Valencia Street in San Francisco. For info, visit www.newcollege.edu, wheelchair accessible.
Arab Women Film Series presents the film Ashikat al Cinema, Women Who Loved Cinema, which chronicles the achievements of six strong-willed women whose adventurous spirits changed the face of the film industry in early 20th century Egypt. Screening on Wednesday, June 28th at 7 p.m. at La Peña Cultural Center, 3105 Shattuck and Woolsey in Berkeley. For info, call 510-849-2568 or visit www.lapena.org. $5 to $10 sliding scale, wheelchair accessible.
Return to Girlville showcases documentary films by a diverse group of Bay Area women filmmakers. Thursday, June 29th at 8 p.m. at the Women's Building, 3543 18th Street in Valencia in San Francisco. For info, call the Women's Building at 415-431-1180 or visit www.womensbuilding.org, wheelchair accessible.
Listen to readings from Let Me Tell You Where I've Been, new writing by women of the Iranian diaspora, an extensive collection of work by women whose lives have been shaped by history, exile, and immigration. Thursday, June 29th at 7 p.m. Modern Times Bookstore, 888 Valencia and 19th Streets in San Francisco. For info, call 415-282-9246 or visit www.mtbs.com. Wheelchair accessible.
The Marsh Theater presents playwright Terry Baum in her one-woman comedy, Baum for Peace, describing her adventures as the Green candidate for U.S. Congress in San Francisco in 2004. Thursday, June 29th through Saturday, July 22nd at 1062 Valencia and 22nd Street in San Francisco. For info, call 415-641-0235 or visit www.themarsh.org. Wheelchair accessible.
The calendar is produced by members of the KPFA Women's Magazine. If you have an upcoming event, please send it to us at kpfawomensprogram@hotmail.com or mail it to Women's Magazine at KPFA, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94704. Let us know if your event is wheelchair accessible.
Thank you for joining us. I have been your host, Lisa Detmer. I would like to thank Yvette and Ileana for helping to make this show possible. If you would like to contact us, you can reach us at 510-848-6767, extension 608. You can hear us again on Monday, July 3rd, from 1 to 2 p.m.